Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear anguished voices from beyond the veil. That and more. But first, if you like this Scary Stories episode you're about to hear, don't forget to check out all our other special series, like our Funny Stuff episodes and our Best of Risk episodes. It's all at risk-show.com/special series.
We'll be right back.
Now here's the show.
Told me I'd be waiting in a pumpkin patch on Halloween night, I'd have said they were crazy.
Just think, Sally, when the great pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch, we'll be here to see him. What's that? I hear the great pumpkin. There he is! There he is!
Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is Mia Farrow, singing the theme from Rosemary's Baby behind me now, because this is the spooktacularly skin-crawling Scary Stories 15, a spine-tingling scream-fest of shadowy skullduggery. Words that start with S. Now, in a little bit, you'll hear from a hauntingly familiar voice, by which I mean Ryan Heller. But before that, a fellow who goes by the eerily mysterious name JB. And here he is now, with a story we call Through the Cracks.
This is a Halloween night. It's the mid-90s. I'm no older than 13, 14 at the time. It's breezy, cool. The sun's going down, it's getting dark. All the kids are going in. There's less and less people out, less and less trick-or-treaters. Lights are going off. It's a sign, it's time to go home. I'm making my way home, and I notice directly across from me is a field, and beyond the field is a fence. And just beyond that are houses. And I'm seeing this glow coming from one of the houses. And I just remember crossing the street, crossing this field. Now the glow's getting brighter as I'm getting closer. And I approach this fence. I can't see over this fence. It's taller than me. I can only see the roof and this glow. But what I can see is the planks. And in between these planks are small little gaps. I squint my left eye. And I'm looking with my right. And what I can make out through the glow is this yard. The grass is dead and needs to be cut. Weeds, bushes, and they need to be trimmed. House doesn't look like it's been taken care of. And I notice, just a little to my left, where the glow is coming from, it's a pool. And this pool, there's a big fire going. I'm looking at the scene and trying to understand what's going on. A little to the right, what appeared to be shadows, figures. Those things around the fire were scarecrows. As the fire goes left, they go left. The fire goes right, they go right. They have these pointed hats, dark shirts, dark pants, straw hat coming out. It was the first time I ever experienced like real fear in my life. All the hairs in my body began to stand up. I got chills. I can't move, either because I'm too scared or I don't want to make a sound. I don't want to cause any attention. As I'm watching, I can hear from my left footsteps. And they're just crunching on whatever is back there, on the dry grass, on the leaves, snapping twigs. I'm looking through this little crack. This crack turns black. And all of a sudden in the gap, I see an eye. And at that instant, I heard a voice. And it said,
"I see you."
That shook me from whatever was binding me. I dashed across that field, went into my house, lights off, locked the doors. Next morning, there was no school, and my attention is on this house. I walked back over and I looked between that fence. What I seen was green grass, taking care of hedges, and where this pool just the night before was a fire, a raging fire, was crystal clear blue water.
The whirligig beetles are wary and fast, with an organ to detect the ripples. Robber flies, with their immobile heads, inject a paralyzing fluid into their prey that they snatch from life in midair. The female praying mantis devours the male while they are mating. The male sometimes continues copulating even after the female has bitten off his head and part of his upper torso. If one places a minute amount of liquor on a scorpion, it will instantly go mad and sting itself to death. It is commonly known that ants keep slaves. Certain species, the so-called sanguinary ants in particular, will raid the nests of other ant tribes and kill the queen, and then kidnap many of the workers. The workers are brought back to the captor's hive, where they are coerced into performing menial tasks. And as we discussed last semester, the army ants will be nothing but your bones. Perhaps you've encountered some of these insects in your communities, displaying both their predatory and defense characteristics while embedded within the walls of flesh and passing for what is most commonly recognized as human.
I met my husband, Chris, 12 years ago after a mystic performed a demonic exorcism on me. So I was in a really dark place in my life at that time, and a family friend intervened and introduced me to Kathy, who's a psychic. Now, I've always been interested in the supernatural. Somehow, holistic healers and mediums and psychics have always been a part of my life. So this was a very normal occurrence. So in our session with Kathy, She told me that my life would be changing completely in a very short amount of time, and said that I would be meeting the love of my life very soon. She described the kind of person he is, the type of environment that I would meet him in, his characteristics, and within 3 weeks, I met my husband, Chris, in the exact manner that Kathy had said I would, and he was exactly as she had described. Chris is incredibly creative. He's entrepreneurial. He's a dreamer, a visionary. He's incredibly organized. I think I would be the balloon that flies away, and he is the hand that grounds me. And it's that balance that has made us strong. A couple of years ago, Chris told me that he has this idea to buy a historic property in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where he's from, called the Whitmere Tavern, the oldest tavern in Pennsylvania. His dream was to convert it into a boutique hotel where we would have weddings and events. I've learned not to stand in the way of Chris and his dreams. So he does his due diligence, travels back and forth from Pennsylvania to Florida, where we were living at the time. And after a couple weeks, he says he's ready to make an offer, and he wanted me to come up and check out the property. So I fly up to Pennsylvania, and as we're driving toward this building, I'm thinking to myself, oh God, please don't let this be it. Please don't let this be it. And he turns into the driveway of this giant old stone tavern. It was, I think, 13 bedrooms, and it has the shutters that are hanging off the windows, glass that's shattered. There's doors that are just hanging off the hinges, vines growing up the side. This is the place that you would see in a horror movie where the kids are walking inside and you're like, what are you doing? Get out of there. Well, we were the ones that were going straight inside. I get out of the car, and we have to now enter through the front door, which is on these kind of bolted hinges, partially coming off the wall. We don't have a key. The realtor's not there to let us in. So we basically have to force the door ajar and try to squeeze our bodies into this building. So we're basically breaking and entering at this point. We get inside, and the walls are covered in mold. The wallpaper is peeling off. There are these beautiful chandeliers that look like they had been from the 1700s when this place was built. But the globes had been filled with water that had turned brown and mucky and were filled with every kind of dead bug that you can possibly imagine. So Chris decides that we should go walking around and wants to explore the basement. I'm petrified at this point. As a Florida native, we don't have basements, let alone these incredibly frightening basements. There's no electricity in the Whitmere Tavern at this point. So we open this little wooden slatted door. It's doing the whole creaky thing that you would expect, and it's pitch black. I'm fighting off cobwebs. I'm feeling things going down my neck. He's saying, let's go. It's fine. It's not a big deal. I'm saying, let's get the fuck out of here. But as what usually happens, I follow Chris down into the basement. And there is the largest fireplace I've ever seen in the back wall. You could fit probably 1,000 dead bodies in this fireplace. And Chris is telling me this would be a lovely place for musicians to set up and play live events. And I'm thinking, are you nuts? So I told Chris that I wasn't going to be going any further until we brought Marjorie with us. Marjorie is our friend in Pennsylvania who's also a psychic. The next day, we all hopped in the car along with me and Chris's two kids, Connor and Olivia. We didn't have a babysitter, so decided to bring them along. They were about 2 years old at the time. So all of us go inside the Whitmere Tavern. Marjorie has her talismans, her crystals. She's got a bottle of holy water. I don't know what she's going to do with all of this. But we go inside. I'm holding our son, Connor. And Chris is holding our daughter, Olivia. And I'm feeling those feelings as a parent where you think we probably shouldn't be doing this. But I go in anyway. We're looking around. I'm seeing the kids' eyes start darting everywhere. They're curious. Marjorie starts telling us what she's seeing, that the Whitmere Tavern is loaded with spirits. They're walking all around us. They are dressed in old colonial attire. But for the most part, these are friendly ghosts, she says. They're happy that we're here and that we would possibly be infusing new energy into the Whitmere Tavern. As we start walking up the stairs to the second floor, I immediately felt a chill. It was like the temperature of the whole house dropped to ice. And I got that feeling in the pit of my stomach, like something was wrong. The hairs in the back of my neck started to stand up. We get into this one large main room on the second floor, and immediately my daughter starts looking in the corner and waving at nothing. And Marjorie says, Olivia's looking at a woman who used to be the caretaker of the Whitmere Tavern. She's over there washing dishes in the corner. And I'm thinking, all right, I mean, I feel like we could work with that. Nothing too threatening. But then I feel my son, who I'm holding, start hyperventilating. And his heart beating. His thumb goes in his mouth and he starts panting, breathing really heavy. And I look at him and his eyes are like these giant saucers and he's staring at something right behind me. And I turn around and there is this room with a tiny black crawl space in the corner. It's just all shadow. You can't see anything in there, but you can feel something. I mean, you can feel evil. And Marjorie says, you need to get out now. She says, there is something coming out of that crawl space. It is this tall, dark, slender figure with like a beak-like face, like the old plague masks that doctors used to wear, and it was stretching up to the ceiling. And it started to come out toward us and was trying to make connection with our son, Connor. And that's all you had to say to me. I said, Chris, we're getting the fuck out of here. I take Connor, Chris takes Olivia, we start going downstairs. And I think Chris is still envisioning what beautiful weddings can be had in this place as we're charging out because he's not quite getting it yet. We're waiting in the driveway and Marjorie eventually comes out. And she says that there was nothing she could do. She tried banishing it. She tried using her trinkets, her holy water. But this thing, it wasn't a spirit. It wasn't a demon. This was like an entity that had been created by pain and suffering. And its sole purpose is to inflict pain and suffering on others, to drain them of their life force. And it wanted to connect with our son, Connor. And I believe it's because children are so open and susceptible. She said we had to immediately go back to where we were staying and douse ourselves in salt water because that would cleanse the negative energy. This is a practice that you do to cleanse spiritually. So we go back. We do exactly that. We take buckets of salt water. Mind you, we're two grown-ass men holding two naked babies in this little tiny bathroom pouring salt water on each other. We get out of the shower and I go to dry off our son Connor and I look at his legs and he has 3 fresh claw marks on the inside of both of his thighs. I was horrified. As somebody who has always been sensitive to the spiritual side, this was something I had never experienced before and never wanted to experience. I couldn't help but become haunted in my own way by the Whitmere Tavern. So we went back to Florida, and I couldn't stop thinking about this place. I began to research it and find out whatever I could. Well, I ended up finding out that the Whitmere Tavern back in the 1800s was a tuberculosis clinic for soldiers during wartime, where they would basically go to die. And it had been for many, many years. And I can only imagine the amount of pain and suffering that had occurred in those rooms and what that had created. The Whitmere Tavern, I found out, has been purchased a few years ago by a man who was going to completely renovate it, move his family in, and I can only imagine the undertaking that they have ahead of them. And it's my best wishes to that man and his family that they only hang out with the friendly ghosts and stay out of any crawl spaces in the second floor.
This is The Unbearables behind me now with a song called Zombies Unite, a call to action for a cohort of folks who are already pretty well known for their solidarity, but we threw that in just in case there's any stragglers out there. Any of you zombies trying to march to the beat of your own drummer? Come on! Stumble around and eat the brains! Before that, we heard an interstitial by our own Taj Easton called Oh My God, There's Something Out There. Before that, Ryan Heller, you can find at ryanheller.com, telling us all about the Whitmere Tavern, which
might have been renovated, but might also remain a portal to an unholy lake of fire. And all that fresh hell was preceded by Tom Waits telling us all about pan-crustacean hexapod invertebrates. And now for something really scary.
The timestamp in the episode where advertisements can go.
We'll be right back.
Folks, do you have a bad habit you'd love to break? Like vaping, overeating, or here's one of mine, doom scrolling. So not good for me. But listen. Atomic Griffin Coaching can help. Do you have a good habit you'd love to make? Like exercising, reading, or meditating? Atomic Griffin Coaching can help. Adam Griffin is a life coach with Atomic Griffin, and he'd love to talk with you about how he can help. Now listen, Adam is a very good friend of mine. We went to college together, and then he resurfaced in my life in 2010 when he pitched the story Fantasy Farm, which is one of the all-time classics, on the Best of Risk number one. I've watched this journey he's taken of becoming a life coach, and it has been so inspirational to see someone really find their calling and just loving it. Especially when that calling is helping people. And full disclosure, Adam is coaching me and JC Cassis, the business director of Risk right now. We've both been so impressed. We've both been doing better. I've already been personally recommending Adam's coaching to other friends. And all you have to do is set up a free discovery session. And he has not one, but two Risk bonuses to offer you. Mention the show when you set up your free discovery session by using the offer code RISK, that's R-I-S-K, and you'll not only get a free Ask the Coach question, you'll also get 10% off your first coaching package. Why wait? To make your life better, simply go to atomic-griffin.com to set up your free discovery session with Adam. That's atomic-griffin.com. And that discovery session is free. Atomic Griffin Coaching can help.
Hey, I've got a female in the grass. There is blood all over the grass, okay?
We may have a serial killer on our hands.
Welcome back to Gone South. I'm Jed Lipinski, and this is Season 3, The Sign Cutter.
I just got this feeling he was the one.
He was the one that what?
That had been murdering.
Binge the entire season of Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, now only on the free Odyssey app, or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock. Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock. Happy, happy Halloween.
Let's get back to the spookiness. In a little bit, we're going to hear from a complete lunatic. But before that, Srilatha Rajamani, who you can find at srilathacomedy.com, is going to take us on a strange little trip to the other side of the world with a story we call First Blood.
This was late 1980s in India, in Bombay, India. My brother and I, and my parents, we lived in Bombay, and summer vacation had started at school. And per usual, every year during the summer holidays, we would leave our apartment in Bombay and head to the south to my dad's, my family's village, where my dad's relatives lived. And that was a tradition. That was what we used to do every year, because my father was raised by his relatives in that village from the time he was a child to an adult. And so he wanted to go back there every year and spend time there. That was his happy place. And for a lot of my childhood, that was my happy place as well, because that is a different life. Like, Bombay is a very modern, advanced city now, and it still was in the 1980s. It was a financial capital of India. It was, you know, where Bollywood is happening, a very modern city. And we were these two city kids in that, you know, village house, which is an entire lifestyle difference. Like, we dressed up in, like, you know, like modern clothes, which were like, you know, salwar and, you know, kurtas and jeans and things like that. Meanwhile, in the village, they wore traditional clothes. The village, you know, my family in the village spoke our language, Tamil, a lot differently than my brother and I did. And none of that mattered when we were like little kids, because, you know, anything kids say is cute, anything kids do is cute, right? But this summer was particularly, because I had started to develop physically. And I don't know why they say girls develop and, you know, for men they don't have an equivalent, but, you know, I was starting to get that physical maturity. And all of a sudden, you know, like, my body had been changing, like, and I was feeling, you know, sensitive a lot more with all the hormonal changes that were going on within me. And that summer vacation was quite different from the ones that we had normally. We went per usual, and, you know, all of my cousins were there, all the relatives. You know, normally we would have the best time. We would be like eating all day, all the fancy, like, well, it was fancy for us, but it was all the traditional South Indian treats that were made at home. Food throughout the day, the best fruits and vegetables. Like, we would get mangoes, fresh coconut from our family farm. It was just like the best. And this started off like that, actually, this holiday as well. We were like exchanging laughs, we were having fun, playing. And then, you know, I noticed that some of my cousins were like making fun of me, which was something they used to do before, but I didn't think of it much. But this year, I was thinking of it a lot more. They were making fun of the way I dressed. They were like, you know, oh my God, look at her. Look at her cheeks, how fair she is. They would pinch my cheeks, and I would be like, this year it felt intrusive compared to the year before. And they made fun of the way I spoke Tamil. And I was just like, I don't want to be so different from all of them. I just want to be like everybody else. And I, you know, I tried to get along with them. I just wanted to do whatever they were doing. One day, my cousins were like milking cows. These are the cousins who were raised in that home, and they were milking the cows. And I was like, hey, I want to do this too. And my cousin Shankar, he said, okay, come on, I'll teach you how to do this. And he went and, you know, he milked the cow that he was, you know, and he showed me. And then he pointed me to a smaller cow and said, try that one. You know, it's small, you're new, you know, you can learn from there. And I started milking that cow. There was no milk coming out. And a little bit later, my cousin Shubha, Shankar's sister, walks by and she's like, hey, what's, you know, why are you milking that one? Like, what? And she called that calf by name. And I realized at once it was a male calf. Now, you know, yes, I was a very innocent kid, but even I know that you can't milk a male calf. And that calf, and as it was milking, made this really weird sound. It went, and I got so mad. I didn't know the implications of what I did, that I'd literally given a hand job to a male calf. No, I didn't know that. But I knew that what Shankar had done to me was humiliating, because Shubha was laughing, Shankar was laughing, the people, the employees in the farm, one of them was laughing, and I was very humiliated. And this news went to my entire, like, you know, cousins group, and all of them were laughing at me. I got so mad that I decided to take revenge. The This is a village house. There is no like closed bathroom doors and things. Like there are courtyards. For the bathing area, there is a courtyard with a well and people go and bathe there. So men go and bathe at a certain time. Women would go at a different time and they would bathe around the well. Now, when my male cousins were all bathing, I decided to spy. And it was easy. It wasn't difficult at all because it's a center courtyard with a lot of doors around it. And you could just peek in through anything and you could just spy on them. Nobody did normally, but I did this time. I spied on them and I started yelling out rude things as they were taking a bath. Aren't you taking a bath properly? Your towel is not wet at all. You don't even have a mustache, yet how is your chest growing hair? Have you soaked your body everywhere? Because I think there are certain places that you haven't soaked yet. Now, they got upset and somehow through like this CIA stealth mode, my mother finds this news and she gets so upset at me. She yells at me. She calls me over in front of all my relatives. She yells at me and she says the way I acted was inappropriate. And she slaps me and she sends me off to my room to, you know, repent. And I'm just like, Mom, do you know what they did? This is just revenge. Mom is not listening to me. She's like, what you did is really awful. You shouldn't be doing this. This was ill-mannered, ill-behaved. And this is not how, you know, you should be as a girl. You shouldn't be behaving like this. And she sends me away. Now, I am humiliated twice over. And so I decided to crawl into my, you know, space where no one else would be there. And for me, that was the second floor of that house, which was usually used for storing grains like fruits, vegetables, and a lot of grains were stored there. And I went there just, it was late afternoon that summer day, and I went there. There was just one light there, like a 40-watt bulb, but the room was really cool, surprisingly, for such a hot day. And I started reading. And I must have gone to sleep because when I woke up, it was dark. It was just like I could see from that small window that was like it was a little bit darker outside. And as I started once again regaining my presence in that room, I'm looking around and I'm seeing this woman. She is dressed like a woman from the village, but also very grandly, like a bride from the village. She is wearing a lot of gold and jewelry, like her nostrils have these two diamonds that are sparkling like stars on a dark night, like the kind of diamonds my grandmother used to wear, with 8 small stones on each side on the nose. And she's wearing like, you know, gold belt, which is what brides wear. And, you know, yeah, and I think, oh yeah, she's a bride, like she's getting married someone here. And village, you know, everybody goes to everybody's house, the doors are open, she's getting married. So I'm just like, okay, maybe she's someone. And as I'm looking at her, she suddenly comes closer and I'm noticing that she's holding this sickle. This is like a thing that in the farm we use to cut coconuts and things. It's like a sickle kind of a knife. She's holding that in her hand. She comes closer to me and she makes a quick movement and she slashes my abdomen. And I feel wetness and I scream and I faint. And when I wake up, I'm seeing my grandmother and my mother. My grandmother is on my head. She's, you know, putting this sacred ash on my forehead and rubbing, and she's chanting shloka. And my mother is, you know, on my hand, she's rubbing, and she's like, you know, and my mom is like, okay, she's awake now, she tells my grandmother. My mom says, okay, you must have had a fright, just, you know, just relax, it's fine. And I'm like, Mom, no, there was this woman in this room, she came and she attacked me, there was blood, I am wounded, we have to go to a doctor, I'm wounded. My mother says, no, you're not wounded, you must have had a bad dream. And I look at my stomach and there is nothing there, I don't, you know, and there's like a, and then I still feel kind of weird and wet, and I look down further and I notice that there is blood in my underpants. So I'm thinking she attacked me down there in the private area. And I'm like, Mom, I'm hurt. here. And my mother and grandmother look at each other and they look a little bit shocked. And then, you know, they talk in low voices and I don't hear them well because I am terrified that I am bleeding. And yet nobody's, you know, thinking of, you know, like taking me to a doctor. What is going on? My mother then says, I'm going to go and prepare a bath for you. And, you know, I'll lay new clothes for you. You can go take a bath once the hot water is ready. And she leaves. After my mother leaves, my grandmother says, what has happened now is important. From now on, your life is going to be different. You can't just be going around and playing with boys anymore. You should not let men touch you. If anybody touches you, you will be the one to be blamed and you will spoil the family's honor. So you should be careful. Even if it's a member of our family, you should stay away from men now. And I'm thinking this is because of, you know, what my cousins did, right? Like, I'm just like, that is not true. They started it first. But my grandmother is like, you know, not thinking of that. She just says, it's okay. Don't worry about it. My mother comes, I take my bath, and then my mother puts me in this room that is separated from everybody else. She says, you have to stay here for the next few days until I tell you when. We will give you food. If you want to go to the bathroom or anything outside this room, you need to let me know so I can make sure that you are going properly. And she hands me, like, you know, like a blanket, a pillow, and she says, I'll bring you food in a while, just stay there. Now I am scared. I'm thinking that I'm being punished. I still don't know what this is all about. My mother has given me these pile of rags, sort of like covered in like a cloth. She says to put it inside, and there's nothing there anymore. The bleeding has stopped. There is nothing there. I tell my mother, Mom, it was probably not a deep wound, but I can't see where the wound is. I keep looking for the wound. And my mom says, no, this is fine. You are going to be fine. And she keeps me there. And there I am for the next few days in this room. And because I'm alone, I keep thinking of that, what happened. And I am terrified. And I don't understand what's going on. And that was the summer. That was that summer. We went back to Bombay. I had learned this is like, you know, a monthly period thing. Only I didn't get that in the following months. I didn't get my period in the following months. And gradually, I had forgotten about that. But, you know, this memory restarted again in a few months when there was news from the village that a grandfather had died. Now, my brother and I didn't know who this person was, but my mom told us we are going to be in mourning for the next 2 weeks because this grandfather died. And we were like, who is that? Because everybody in the village is a grandfather, an uncle, an auntie. You know, it doesn't matter. And they were like, who is this one? And my mother said, do you remember this old man who used to sit in that front porch of that house? And we thought, oh my God, that's that crazy grandfather. Like, we all called him a crazy grandfather because we only saw him sitting in the front porch of that house. We thought he was blind because his eyes wouldn't ever, like, you know, focus on anybody or anything. He just sat there silent. People were scared to approach him because he was scary to look at, but he didn't really speak. So we all thought he was crazy. And he had died. After that, we had a lot of relatives coming to inquire about, you know, his passing, and they would all be talking. And I would hear bits and pieces of the conversation, which is when I found that he was just not some random grandfather in the village. He was my great-grandfather's brother. He was literally, you know, my father's uncle. And I was just like, oh my God, this is quite a close relative compared to that. And through all the things that people would drop in, they would say, oh my God, this man is so unfortunate. You know, he really paid the price for the act that he committed, but he lives such a horrible life. I hope that, you know, in his next life, you know, he gets reborn in a better way. And it was like, okay, what did he do? Like, finally, do we have anything exciting in our family, right? What did this man do? And that's when I found bits and pieces again through a lot of conversations that he was actually the head of the family at one time. My grandfather's dad was not the head of the family. He was a second son. This man was supposed to be like the family head. When he was young, he had gotten married to somebody in the next village, and that wedding was the talk of the village because she was from a very rich family. She was gorgeous and, you know, very, very, very accomplished. And everybody was like, oh my God, how did that person, you know, bring herself down to marry someone like you? Because we were an ordinary family. Like, we were farmers, we were teachers, but we were not like rich people. And how did this happen? So people were like envious. A lot of them were giving congratulations. And all through the 10 days of that wedding, which is how in our weddings used to be, they weren't on for 10 days. Everybody was like, you know, discussing, congratulating, gossiping about this. And soon the gossip took a different turn. Some people were like, there is a reason why that woman who is beautiful and accomplished and wealthy came to, you know, marry this person. It's because, you know, she had an affair. She had a lover and the family didn't want that. So they are forcing her to marry this person. And that reaches my great-grandfather's brother's ears and he just gets really upset. On the wedding night, he confronts her and he says she is unchaste and, you know, she has spoiled his family's honor. And this woman gets really angry and upset. She protests at innocence and she says that what you have said now, my honor has been destroyed. I cannot live anymore. And then on her wedding night, she kills herself with a knife. And as she is dying, she curses him and she curses our family. She says, I am dying because of what you said. I'm going to die without, you know, consummating my marriage. That is what is going to happen to you. Anybody you marry will die. And your family line will end. And she curses and she dies. Now, this man hears that and he suddenly feels very remorseful of what he did. He is shocked and, you know, they say that that made him crazy. But probably he was so shocked that, you know, he couldn't like handle this guilt anymore. And he spends the rest of his life repenting his actions. He gave up on being a part of the world, part of the community. He just existed in that porch for the rest of his life. Meanwhile, the family then focused on his brother, who was going to be my great-grandfather. They asked him to get married, and he gets married. But he marries twice, and each time the person he marries dies. And now the family is really concerned. They are like, oh my God, that curse is still holding on. We don't know what to do. They consult a holy person who says, what you have is a curse because of, you know, like, we call it pavam. Pavam is like sin, but with the Hindu culture, like, you know, that is always a consequence to your actions. Good actions have good consequences and bad have bad consequences. So they say this action has to have its consequence due to karma. So you have to deal with this. But there is a way around this. She did a sin by killing herself. Suicide is a sin. She did the sin by killing herself. You take on that sin from her and the curse can be neutralized. So what you have to do is kill the person you marry. But not a person in this case. You know, you have to marry and then kill. And then, you know, after that, anytime you marry, you know, you will not have this curse attached to you anymore because the karma will be satisfied. So he then, what they do is like they arrange a marriage for my great-grandfather's brother with a banana tree, like a young banana tree. Banana tree is considered as a woman, as a female and a virgin because it hasn't borne fruit yet. So a young banana tree. And he gets married to the banana tree. Then he cuts off the banana tree. And after that, he gets married to the person who becomes my great-grandmother. And since then, you know, it has been working out in the family. And that was the story of that man's and his brother's life and this woman. And hearing this story, I realized that this is the woman I had seen. There could be no other explanation. I hadn't seen that woman ever since. And she was in that house because she was married in that house. And she had, you know, left that house in such a horrible way. And I think her soul was still in there. And I, you know, to date, I believe that. I believe that this is a woman I saw. I haven't been able to confirm this with my family because no one in my family will talk about this. But the banana tree is very important in my family. Through all family festivals, like a puja that we do or like a wedding or like any grand, like Diwali, anything, we always have a banana tree. Like we get the banana tree, which is part of the celebration. And then afterwards, the tree is sent out for being planted outside. So that's what we do. And I thought it was normal. I thought all Hindu families did this, except I found they don't. So I do know that that action of that night of, you know, those decades ago is still like, you know, part of my family. And that's why I believe that this woman is still in that house. In India, like a person who gets their period, like a woman who getting their period, is treated really badly now. And it has always been there, like especially in the remote areas and the villages and conservative families like mine. I was in college in Bombay. When I had my period, I couldn't sit with my parents and eat. My mother would just like put a plate with food and she would just roll it on the floor, like slide it across. Anything I touched was considered unclean. There was a lot of discrimination in my family, although they loved me. Meanwhile, in the villages, it is even worse. So there is just this onus on women that because you are now capable of bearing children, you should be pure. Men are never at fault. It is still the woman's fault. It is part of the culture in India, even now. So I think my encounter with this woman was in a way to prepare me for all the hardships that I was going to be seeing in life as a woman, and to tell me to be brave. I think that was the reason why. I don't think she meant to harm me. She was trying to give me courage. And that has been something that has stood with me. I am a queer person, and growing up in India, it was hard being what I am in this body and being like a person who had to behave in a certain way, get married, have a child, only per my parents' instructions and nothing else. When I came to America after I had my own daughter, I realized that I can't be like that anymore. During my wedding, my mother gave me this silver kumkum. It's like a red vermilion powder thing. She gave it to me in hand and she said, "This belonged to that ancestor." And every time I would see it, I would be like, I can't, you know, I have to, at least like there is a reason why she met me that night. So I can't be, just because I'm a woman, it doesn't mean I have to live like this. I have to find my own path. That is what I think she taught me. I raised my daughter, I hope, differently than the way I was raised. And someday I will tell my daughter this whole story and I will pass on that silver kumkum container that belonged to that lady to her. Because I think this is a family legacy that she needs to hold on to. A legacy of being proud of who you are, being proud that you're a woman, of not feeling ashamed of yourself because of your body or your feelings or your choices.
You've all heard of me and the things I've done. Satan chauffeur, don't play for fun. This coach is pulled with firebred steeds, and I know every one of your wrong deeds. Your name is on a page of our big book. Rich man, poor man, thief or crook, and it makes no difference how you moan. Oh, Satan and I want to hear you groan.
Don't come to us on bended knees. We won't hear one of your false pleas. You had your chance and passed it by. Come on, sinner, now let's hear you cry.
I grew up in the suburbs of Ohio, and when I was 18, I was so excited because I was moving to New York to go to film school at NYU. But everyone I knew said, "New York? Isn't it dangerous? I mean, you see the movies, it's people jumping out of the shadows, jamming knives in you." But, you know, from my perspective, after 18 years there, Cincinnati was boring. And from what I could see in the movies, in New York, you could also have gay sex. I mean, if that meant being shoved in front of an oncoming train every now and then, everything's got its price. But the more I heard those fears expressed, the more I started to think, you know, screw it. I welcome the danger. You know, I can hardly wait for a good New York scare. That's probably why people find New York so exciting. And you should know, this was the 80s before the rich turned the city into a family theme park. So, you know, it really was still pretty interesting. And yeah, sometimes dangerous. So on my first day in the big city, I was walking in Greenwich Village on my way to freshman orientation when I looked up and I noticed a young woman leaning out her apartment window about four floors up. She's red in the face and screaming at her boyfriend on the sidewalk right as I was passing by him, saying, "And take your fish too!" And she threw a big round fishbowl with a gallon and a goldfish that went whizzing by my head and smashed to pieces at my feet. Well, this kind woman ran up to save the goldfish, which I was too stunned to do because all I could think was, wow, you know, never mind NYU. I'm really getting schooled in these streets. That was dangerous. But that was when I was still just starting to learn that behind closed doors, any town can be dangerous in much stranger ways. You see, my parents couldn't afford for me to be living in the dorms at NYU, so they arranged that I live about an hour south with my older brother Dave in a crumbling tenement apartment near Coney Island, deep in the bowels of Brooklyn. Now, my brother was just out of college himself and barely scraping by, and he didn't really have what you could call a furnished apartment. But the prior tenants had been good enough to leave behind a piece with a lot of character. It was a twin-sized mattress on the floor, and I could still make out some of the words on the label, the name Macy's, and the year 1949. But the most distinguishing characteristic of this object was that smack dab in the middle was what appeared to be a giant, decades-old, maroon-brown stain, which was not necessarily blood. I mean, there was no reason to jump to the conclusion that it was blood, and it was pretty much obviously blood. My brother said, "Oh, and Kev, that thing can be yours." And so, for my first night in New York, I flipped that thing over to its less befouled side and went to sleep. Deep in the night, I was drifting down in dreams, in waves of haze and shadows, as if I was floating in the depths of cold, dark seawater. And underneath me, I saw something coming up from the murk and the slime, floating up toward me, growing bigger. Then I saw it was an old hag, rotting, hissing, dark green bubbles belching from her mouth. She seemed to be biting and chewing the water, spiraling up to me, chunks of her purple bloated flesh peeling right off of her, and her eyes blazing yellow like pus. She was growling and barking and shrieking. shrieking and biting at my leg when my mind bubbled up to the surface and I realized I was really hearing those sounds coming from under the mattress. I sat up in bed and could clearly hear an old lady screaming.
You are the most miserable loser on earth. I wish I'd never given birth to an abomination like you. Fuck you!
Then I heard something like a plate smashing into a wall, shattering into pieces, and another voice, a male voice, whimpering, almost helpless. Well, I was wide awake now, and my brother Dave was too. He came stumbling out of his room and said, Kev, fuck. I forgot to tell you. Two people who live in the apartment below, the old lady and her son, she's got to be in her 80s. He must be in his 50s. She screams at him constantly and throws things. I mean, I've been wondering if I should talk to the landlord about it or someone. He said, anyway, welcome to New York. And he wasn't kidding. These blow-ups would happen all the time, and we could hear them so clearly. Well, we could hear her clearly, because she was much louder than his moaning and murmuring. It might be any time of day or night, and there she was yelling at him again.
You are such a waste! What did I do to deserve a son like you? Fuck you!
He fought back sometimes, but not that forcefully. Mostly I'd just hear him grumbling and whining like an abused animal.
What am I doing? Leave me alone!
Maybe he had something like Stockholm Syndrome. But Dave and I were new here. I mean, we were basically kids, fresh from Ohio, strangers in a strange land. You know, shouldn't someone else in the building have looked into this? We didn't even know what these two looked like. So, a few weeks into film school, I had to write a paper on one of my favorite movies, Hitchcock's Rear Window, where Jimmy Stewart becomes so obsessed with trying to figure out what the people in the apartments around him are up to in private that it puts his life in terrible danger. I was so excited to be out of high school and for the first time to have to do homework that I was really interested in. So I came home that day, smoked a joint, put a cassette of Kinda Blue by Miles Davis on the boombox, kicked back on my beloved mattress, and got to writing. Now, as far as Miles Davis music goes, Kinda Blue, it's not exactly bitch's brew. You know, it's soft, mellow jazz. And I had it playing at a low, relaxing volume. So I was pretty blissed out, almost meditating on my memories of hypnotic Hitchcock sequences, kind of drifting off. And then, bam! I thought, oh my God, there was a gunshot. There was a gunshot in the building. And then, bam, bam! I thought, no, it's our door. Bam, bam, bam! Someone was beating on our door with a blunt object. But it was so violently loud, it was like RoboCop was busting in. I was creeping up to the door while the hallway seemed to expand and spiral in front of and behind me. The door had one of those circular peepholes where you look through and get a fishbowl view. And there she was. To my amazement, she couldn't have been a hell of a lot more than 5 feet tall. But her bulging eyes were bloodshot and her white hair was going everywhere like she'd stuck her thumb in a socket. She was baring her teeth like a Doberman. The face of pure rage. And in her fists was a broomstick that she'd been using every bit of the insane energy in her body to beat into our door like Ahab stabbing the whale. Now, the door had a chain lock on it, so I locked it and I carefully cracked it open about an inch. I was polite as could be because, you know, I'm from Ohio. I said, "Can I help you?" She practically spat at me, like the girl from The Exorcist as an octogenarian. She said, "You imbecile! You with the blaring loud music and the constant jumping up and down and screaming up here! Fuck you!" I didn't know what to say, so I just said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll do my very best to be quieter." But she just went on screaming, and I just had to close the door. I kind of lost my appetite for writing about Jimmy Stewart figuring out he's about to be murdered by his neighbor, so I just sat in stunned silence till my brother came home. And he said, "Kev, what the fuck happened?" Our door was metal of some sort, and he'd immediately noticed the huge dents left in the door. But also, she'd apparently taken a white plastic bag, you know, the kind they give you in a cheap grocery store, and filled it with bleach, like a gallon of bleach, and sat it down in front of our door so that it kind of became a puddle of bleach with a plastic bag collapsed around it. So it seemed like one of those symbolic gestures in The Godfather that, you know, like non-Italian people need translated for them, like, "Oh yeah, this happened in an opera. When the welcome mat's a bag of bleach, you're gonna soil your panties." But no, of course, it wasn't something like that. It was just that she was mentally ill. She normally took it out on her son, and now she was coming at us. And, you know, you have to be careful at times like those, because your subconscious wants to start fighting back because you're being attacked. But you have to stay conscious of the fact that your attacker is living in a different reality and most likely just needs help. But a few days later, my brother walked through the door again and said, "Kev, I finally saw the old lady downstairs. She was out cold on a stretcher being taken out of that apartment." He said, "There was an ambulance waiting outside." So we both wondered what had happened. Then, a couple days later, Mr. Ephraim knocked on the door, the landlord. He was a Hasidic guy. We got along fine. He said, "Hey guys, if you know anyone who needs a new place, the apartment right below you is available." Dave said, "Oh, wow, what happened to the old lady and her son?" Mr. Ephraim said, "She died a couple days ago." "What do you mean, her son?" Dave said, "She was always screaming." Mr. Ephraim said, "Yeah, tell me about it. She probably screamed herself to death." I said, "But she was screaming at her son." He said, "Nah. He died a decade ago. She lived down there all alone." Behind closed doors, New York is like any other town. It can be dangerous, but in ways you might not see coming. Like how it turned out, Rear Window wasn't the Hitchcock film we were living through that fall. We were living through something like the reverse of Psycho. And you don't want to argue with a family like that, because a boy's best friend is his mother.
Thank you.
This is Dead Man's Bones behind me now, singing a song called Dead Man's Bones. Just how you know, they love Dead Man's Bones. They are Ryan Gosling and film producer Zach Shields. And before those fellas, yours truly. With a story that was so beautifully edited and sound designed by Taj Easton, who also did the interstitial that preceded, that came out of Jimmy Minor singing about being Satan's chauffeur, who is apparently only interested in hearing you cry, sinner. What do you think of that? Well, folks, there's always great bonus content to be found at patreon.com/risk, and this week we have an especially creepy story told by Andrew and Dale, a family story shared about ghosts and scary neighbors. And by becoming a member at patreon.com/risk, you can help us continue to create so many remarkable listening experiences like these. And if you want to make a one-time donation, that's at paypal.me/riskshow.
We'll be right back. We're back.
Well, folks, next week, we'll get back to not-so-scary stuff. Mostly. Just mostly. But that's next week. And folks, today is the day. Take a risk.
Little ghost!